I want you to take a second and just think about where your actual self lives. Like every memory you hold on to, every complex skill you've ever learned, your entire perception of the room you're sitting in right now, all of that is currently happening within this sheet of tissue just behind your forehead that is roughly what, 2 to 4 millimeters thick?
Yeah, it's staggering when you actually stop and visualize it.
Yeah.
I mean, 2 to 4 millimeters. That
Right.
is basically the thickness of a standard wedding band.
A piece of jewelry. Your entire reality is contained in a sliver of tissue the size of a piece of jewelry.
It's wild.
It really is. So we've got this massive stack of anatomical and biological research for today's deep dive.
We do, yeah, lots of ground to cover.
And our mission here is to unpack how, like, 14 to 16 billion neurons fit into that tiny space, and also how they actively build themselves from the inside out, which is crazy. We're going to go from the macro level folds down to the microscopic wiring.
And we're also going to look at its surprisingly ancient evolutionary origins, right?
Exactly. I promise that by the time we finish this deep dive, you will never look at your own brain or, the brains of elephants, birds, or even sea worms in the exact same way again.
You really won't. I mean, it fundamentally shifts your perspective on what intelligence actually even is.
Right. So before we get into the microscopic wiring, we kind of need to address the bizarre physical packaging.
Omelet shape.
Yeah. Why does the human brain look like a wrinkled walnut?
Well, in anatomical terms, those outer folds and ridges, they're called gyri, and the deep grooves between them are sulci.
Okay.
But, the vocabulary is nearly as important as the actual mechanism of gyrification itself, which is essentially, it's an extreme evolutionary solution to latency.
Latency. See, my first thought was always that it's just a space issue.
Oh, like just fitting it in the skull.
Yeah, exactly. Like you're trying to cram this massive sheet. I think our sources say if you unfolded the cortex, it'd be about a quarter of a square meter total into this tiny little glove box of a skull. But a much better way to look at it, especially for anyone who has ever built a computer or worked in IT, is cable management in a massive server farm.
Oh, that is a much more accurate framework.
Absolutely, it's about speed, right?
Right, exactly. When you have billions of neurons that need to talk to each other in like fractions of a second, physical distance is your absolute worst enemy.
Wow. Okay.
So by folding the cortex, regions of the brain that need to communicate constantly are physically brought closer together. The biological wiring is literally shorter.
This is a shortcut.
Exactly. And that minimizes lag,
Yeah.
speeds up processing, and it actually saves an enormous amount of metabolic energy.
So if latency is the main issue, I mean, that perfectly explains why smaller mammals like mice or shrews have completely smooth brains.
Yeah, they do.
They just don't have enough neurons to generate that kind of communication lag, right?
Yeah.
The distances inside their skulls are already microscopic.
Right. They just don't need the extreme folds to optimize their circuitry.
Right.
But, as brains scale up in size across different species, those major deep folds become a physical necessity.
Right.
And they actually begin to act as borders, dividing the cerebrum into distinct functional territory.
Now the lobes.
Yes, exactly. They map out the four main lobes we always hear about in basic biology class, the frontal, parietal, occipital, and temporal lobes. And then there's the limbic lobe on the medial side and the insular cortex, which is actually completely hidden. It's buried deep within those folds.
Wow. You know what really stands out in the research stack is the actual thickness of this tissue.
Oh, the scaling.
Yeah, we said 2 to 4 millimeters for humans, but that thickness scales logarithmically with overall brain weight across species.
It's fascinating.
Right. Like a tiny shrew has a cortex about 0.5 millimeter thick. But then you look at a fin whale, one of the largest animals on Earth with this massive, heavy brain, and their cortex is essentially the exact same thickness as ours, like right in that 2 to 4 millimeter range.
It's so consistent. And even within your own head right now, that thickness actually fluctuates depending on the job of that specific area.
Oh, really?
Yeah, generally speaking, your sensory cortex, so the areas processing touch, sight, and sound, that's visibly thinner than your motor cortex, which is responsible for executing voluntary movements.
Which ties into a really interesting clinical curiosity mentioned in the research.
Oh, the migraine studies.
Yes, if you're someone listening who suffers from chronic migraines, early MRI studies suggested you might actually have a thicker somatosensory cortex.
Right, which is the specific part of the brain that processes pain and touch.
Exactly. So the medical community was stuck in this chicken and egg scenario. Does the repeated trauma of pain attacks physically thicken the tissue over time? Or does a naturally thicker cortex make someone prone to migraines?
And that whole debate perfectly demonstrates why we can't just stop at early observational studies.
Right, because the later stuff showed something different.
Yeah, later, much more robust studies with massive patient populations found no significant change in cortical thickness for migraine patients at all.
Wow, so it was just a false positive.
Pretty much. It turns out trying to map a highly subjective, complex experience like chronic pain directly to a physical structural change in the brain tissue is incredibly difficult.
Yeah, that makes sense. So we've established that the brain folds itself to minimize latency and speed up communication.
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually slice into that 2-millimeter fold to see the physical wiring that requires such a tight layout, what are you actually looking at?
Well, you're looking at the neocortex, which makes up about 90% of your cerebral cortex. And when early neuroanatomists first stained cross-sections of this tissue back in the early 20th century, they didn't just find a random messy jumble of cells.
Right. It's not just a soup.
Far from it. They found this incredibly structured, highly organized architecture divided into 6 distinct horizontal layers.
6 layers. I keep visualizing this as like a highly efficient 6-story factory building.
That's a great way to think about it.
Right. Where every single floor handles a specific part of the cognitive supply chain. But before we break down what each floor does, let me see if I can synthesize a rule here based on evolution.
Okay, let's hear it.
If layers equal intelligence, does that mean like humans have 6, a cat has maybe 4, and a frog has 2, like a ladder?
You would think it works like that, right?
Yeah.
Like a clean ladder of progress, building up layer by layer as animals get smarter.
Yeah, that seems logical.
But nature absolutely hates ladders. African elephants are some of the most socially complex, highly intelligent mammals alive.
Yeah.
And their cortex is entirely missing layer 4.
Wait, what? They just skipped a floor of the factory.
Completely missing.
How does their brain even process information without a whole floor?
So to understand how wild that evolutionary deviation is, we really need to look at what layer 40 normally does in us.
Okay.
In a human brain, layer 4 is the internal granular layer. It basically functions as the factory's receiving dock.
The receiving dock, got it.
It's the primary target for incoming sensory information from the thalamus, which is this structure deeper in the brain acting as a central relay station.
Mm-hmm.
But in elephants, as well as whales and hippos, those sensory inputs bypass the traditional receiving dock entirely and wire straight into layer 3.
That completely breaks the mold. I mean, it proves there isn't just one single rigid blueprint for building a highly intelligent mammalian brain.
It absolutely shatters the blueprint. But, you know, going back to the standard human factory design, once layer 4 receives that raw sensory data, it needs to be processed and contextualized.
Right, you can't just leave it on the dock.
Exactly. And that's where layers 2 and 3 come into play. We call them the external granular and external pyramidal layers.
I notice those 2 layers get glossed over a lot in basic biology summaries. What are they actually doing with all that data?
Well, they serve as the internal communication network.
Okay.
So while other layers are busy talking to the outside world or the spinal cord, layers 2 and 3 are entirely focused on talking to other parts of the cortex.
Oh, I see.
They send signals across the hemispheres via the corpus callosum, basically bridging the gap so your left brain knows exactly what your right brain is doing.
Like an internal intercom system.
Yeah. They are making the vast web of connections that allow for complex associations and higher level thinking.
Okay. So layer 4 gets the raw data. Layers 2 and 3 share it across the brain to figure out what it means.
Right.
But what happens when I finally need to act on it? Like deciding to reach out and grab my glass of water right here.
Ah, so that physical command gets shipped down to layer V, the internal pyramidal layer.
The shipping department.
Exactly. This floor contains these massive structures called giant pyramidal Betz cells.
Betz cells, okay.
And they're axons, which you can basically picture as long biological transmission cables.
Mm-hmm.
They leave the cortex, travel all the way through the brainstem, and go straight down your spinal cord to directly control your muscles.
That's incredible. And sitting right beneath that is layer 6, right? The bottom floor, right above the white matter.
Yeah.
And for anyone unfamiliar, white matter is essentially the brain's dense underlying network of biological fiber optic cables connecting different brain regions.
Perfect analogy. So layer 6-6 sits right on top of that network, acting as the quality control department.
Quality control, how so?
Well, it sends feedback fibers back down to the thalamus, and the precision here is just breathtaking.
Really?
Yeah, neurons from one specific column of the cortex connect back to the exact thalamic neurons that feed them.
Yeah.
It operates as an adjustable gain control.
Oh, like a volume dial.
Exactly. Layer 6 can send an excitatory signal to turn the volume up on a specific sensory input, or an inhibitory signal to filter it out as just background noise.
Wow, which brings us all the way up to the roof, layer one.
The molecular layer.
Or what I like to think of as the CEO suite.
It's a very sparse, strange layer, honestly. It doesn't have many neuron cell bodies of its own.
Then what's in there?
Instead, it's mostly made up of apical tufts. These are the extending tree-like branches from neurons down to the deeper layers.
Oh, reaching all the way up.
Yeah, they reach all the way up to the surface, mingling with a massive web of connections coming from other parts of the brain.
So the research describes layer I as integrating ascending sensory inputs with top-down expectations. Let's try to ground that in reality. Think about the room you, the listener, are sitting in right now. Your brain's top-down expectation already knows the layout of your furniture, the color of the walls, where the door is.
Right, you have a mental model, but your bottom-up sensory input is just raw incoming data. So if the lights are off, your eyes only see vague, dark shapes. Layer I is where the brain combines what you expect to see with the raw data of what you're actually seeing.
It's comparing notes.
Exactly. It dynamically gates and sorts these signals, essentially shaping your real-time perception of reality.
So if I jump because I think a shadow in the corner is an intruder, but it turns out to be a coat rack.
That is layer I misinterpreting the data and allowing your expectations to override reality.
That is wild. Knowing how this incredibly complex six-layered factory operates forces a massive logistical question, though.
How it's built.
Yeah. How does a developing fetus actually build this structure from scratch? My assumption, and I think most people's natural assumption, is that building a brain must be exactly like building a house.
Foundation first.
Right. You pour the foundation, build the first floor, then the second floor, and eventually cap it with the roof.
It's a perfectly logical assumption that happens to be completely backward.
Wait, really?
Yeah, the cerebral cortex is actually built inside out.
Walk us through that mechanism, because how do you physically build a biological structure inside out?
So during embryonic development, the cortex starts near the ventricles, which are these fluid-filled cavities deep inside the neural tube.
And the neural tube becomes the nervous system.
Exactly. Down in this deep zone, you have these incredible structures called radial glia.
Okay.
You could think of radial glia as serving two distinct purposes. They are the stem cell factory workers producing the new neurons, but they also form the physical scaffolding the neurons use to move.
Wait, so they create a brand new neuron and then basically hand it a pole to climb?
Literally. They provide these long physical fibers that stretch all the way from the deep ventricular zone up to the outer surface of the developing brain.
That is bizarre.
It gets crazier. When a new neuron is born, it physically crawls up this radial glial scaffolding. The very first neurons generated migrate out and form the deepest layers of the mature cortex layers 6 and 5.
Okay, so the foundation is laid first. That part makes sense.
But when the next batch of neurons is born, they migrate up the scaffolding and travel past the older neurons.
Wait, they climb through them?
Yes, they climb right through layers 6 and 5 to form layer 4. And then the next batch climbs past 6, 5, and 4 to form layer 3. So the youngest, newest neurons are always navigating through densely packed older cells to reach the superficial upper layers.
That sounds exhausting for the cells. Are there any exceptions to that inside-out rule?
There is one notable exception, and it actually happens in primates.
Oh, us.
Yeah. In rodents, the creation of neurons eventually just stops. But in us, neurogenesis for layer I, that CEO suite we talked about, actually continues throughout the entire period of cortical development.
It was still building the roof.
Right. It continuously adds new cells to the top layer while the rest of the cortex is being built inside out beneath it.
This brings up a massive coordination problem, though. If a radial glial cell is just pumping out blank slate stem cells, how does a given neuron know what its permanent job is?
That is the big question.
Like, how does it know, oh, I need to process vision at the back of the head versus I need to control arm movement at the front?
This brings us to cortical patterning, which is essentially a molecular tug of war.
A tug of war.
Yeah. Early in embryonic development, there is a primordial blueprint called the protomap. The functional landscape of this map is determined by opposing gradients of chemicals, specifically transcription factors like MX2 and PAX6.
Okay, MX2 and PAX6, but how does a chemical gradient actually tell a cell what to become?
Think of these chemicals not as static paint on a canvas, but as fading gradients of sound.
Like a speaker.
Exactly, like the volume of music fading as you walk away from a concert speaker.
Right.
A blank stem cell basically listens to how loud the MX2 signal is versus the PAX6 signal.
No, I see.
That precise ratio of chemical volume flips specific genetic switches inside the cell to turn it into a visual neuron versus a motor neuron.
Our sources note that MX2 is highly concentrated at the back of the brain where the visual cortex lives, right?
Yes.
And PAX6 is highly concentrated at the front in the motor region, so they naturally push against each other. What happens if one of those signals gets weak, say, through a genetic mutation?
Well, if a mutation weakens PAX6, its chemical volume drops. And without PAX6 pushing back, MX2 physically expands its territory outward.
Wait, it just takes over.
Yes. The area of the brain normally dedicated to visual processing actually gets larger, physically taking over space that should have been dedicated to motor control.
That's incredible.
It is a literal microscopic turf war, determining the physical layout of your cognitive functions.
You know, the research also mentions signaling proteins like fibroblast growth factor 8 or FGF8 regulating this border war.
Oh, right. The lab studies.
Yeah. If scientists artificially introduce FGF8 into the wrong part of a developing cortex in a lab setting, they completely disrupt this pattern, causing a physical shift in where functional areas develop.
It's wild to see.
It proves the brain's layout isn't a rigid schematic. It's this dynamic, fragile equilibrium of chemical signals.
It is entirely dependent on those gradients maintaining their precise balance. If they're off, the whole map shifts.
So we have this highly optimized, folded, six-layered factory that builds itself backward using chemical volume dials.
Quite the summary, yeah.
And the traditional narrative in biology is that the cerebral cortex is this uniquely high-level mammalian feature, like the ultimate biological hardware that separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom.
Right. But if we step back and look at the broader evolutionary timeline, we really have to dismantle that sense of human exceptionalism.
Because we aren't that special.
Well, because evolution didn't sit down and invent a completely new blueprint just for the human mind.
It didn't reinvent the wheel. It just bought more wheels.
Exactly. That is the core of the radial unit hypothesis, proposed by researcher Pasco Rakich.
Okay, what does that theory state?
The theory states that evolution created new functional areas in the cortex simply by adding more radial units, more of those stem cell scaffolding columns we just talked about.
So instead of designing a fundamentally different type of neuron or a completely new way of processing data, evolution just scaled up the server farm.
Exactly.
It essentially said, let's increase the factory's footprint and build 100,000 more columns.
And it all happens at the stem cell level. By slightly increasing the number of radial glial cells, dividing early in development, you exponentially expand the surface area of the mature cortex.
Which gives us more computing power.
Right, that creates the physical space needed for new, complex association areas, the parts of our brain that handle abstract thought, planning, language, creativity.
That covers how mammals scaled up. But our sources point to some wild structural similarities outside of mammals entirely.
Oh, you mean the birds?
Yes, looking at birds. For a long time, I think the scientific consensus was that only mammals had this kind of complex, layered architecture capable of advanced thought, right?
That was the dogma for decades. But recent evidence shows that the avian brain, specifically a structure called the pallium, has a neuroarchitecture that is incredibly reminiscent of our cerebral cortex.
Which suddenly makes perfect sense when you look at crows or ravens or parrots.
Solving multi-step puzzles.
Yeah, using tools, mimicking human speech. They're terrifyingly smart.
They are. The avian pallium is now recognized as providing an equivalent neural basis for consciousness.
Wow.
They don't have the exact same six-layer mammalian neocortex, but their evolutionary path arrived at a parallel structure capable of incredibly high-order cognition.
That's mind-blowing on its own, but the ultimate shocker in our research stack today is a 2010 study published in the journal Cell.
Oh, the ragworm study.
Yeah. Researchers were looking for counterparts to the cerebral cortex in invertebrates, and they found a profound connection in a sea worm, the ragworm, Platanaris Tumorillo?
Yes, and they were analyzing gene expression profiles.
What does that mean in this context exactly?
Well, when scientists talk about gene expression profiles here, they aren't just looking at whether two animals happen to share a specific gene. They're looking at how and where those genes are actively turned on to build specific cells and structures.
Okay.
And molecular signatures of the cells in our cerebral cortex share a deep, unmistakable affinity with structures in the ragworm's brain called mushroom bodies.
Mushroom bodies are the structures responsible for learning and spatial memory in many worms and insects,
They
right?
are. And this deeply shared gene expression strongly suggests that our cerebral cortex and the ragworm's mushroom bodies share a common evolutionary origin.
The genetic precursors to your ability to do calculus or build a skyscraper or, listen to this deep dive, those specific genetic instructions date back to sea worms in the Precambrian era, hundreds of millions of years ago. The fundamental molecular toolkit for learning and memory was already there, drifting in ancient oceans. The architecture of our cognition is deeply rooted in the very earliest history of complex life on Earth.
It's honestly hard to wrap my head around. Let's bring this journey full circle for you, listener.
Yeah, good idea.
We started by trying to locate yourself, and what we found is this wrinkled sheet of tissue, the thickness of a wedding band, sitting just behind your forehead.
It is a marvel of spatial efficiency, folded like cables in a server farm to eliminate lag. It is a six-story factory that builds itself inside out, guided by microscopic chemical turf wars, and its lineage stretches all the way back to the dawn of complex life.
It is arguably the most complex structure we know of in the universe, and yet it shares its foundational software with a ragworm.
Which leaves us with a final thought to ponder as you go about your day. If the architecture of the human cerebral cortex is essentially built on a primordial map, one that simply keeps adding more vertical columns to increase computing power, is the difference between human genius and an animal's basic instinct simply a matter of quantity?
It's a huge question.
Right. Are we not utilizing a fundamentally different kind of mind? Are we just running the exact same prehistoric software as a worm, just on a massively scaled-up server?